So I want to tell you about some work that I've done over the last year or so with my students Sam Grella and postdoc Abe Hart. This work has been published in PhysRevD and is on the archive, so you can refer there for any further details that I won't have time to necessarily to get into all of, but I'll have time to get into a lot. So let me first start with just what the basic issue is, which is one that I think is familiar to everyone who's taken a course in electromagnetism, certainly by the time you're at the graduate level and even at the undergraduate level. So as everybody knows, an accelerating point charge radiates electromagnetic energy and momentum. So it can't get away with doing this without having some effect on it, or you wouldn't have conservation of energy. There's got to be some kind of radiation reaction force on the charge. And one can understand the origin of this very easily also, because the charge is producing an electromagnetic field, and that electromagnetic field ought to act on the charge itself as well. I mean, the charge isn't immune from its own electromagnetic field. But now if you try to calculate that, you run into major problems. If you try to calculate it with the Lorentz force law, you run into the problem that the field of a point charge is singular at the charge itself, so it doesn't make any sense to plug that into the Lorentz force equation. If you try to use a conservation of energy argument, you run into the immediate problem that the electromagnetic self-energy of a point charge is infinite. So it's just not obvious how to do a proper self-force or energy conservation argument. And this has been something that's been a subject of debate and discussion for actually more than a century. Now, I've often been accused of being, and correctly so, being a bit behind the times in my research. I haven't usually been a whole century behind the times. So let me just mention that our main motivation for this work is the corresponding gravitational case, because there's certainly considerable interest in finding the motion of a small body in general relativity, taking into account its self-force effects. In particular, if one would certainly like to have a complete understanding in detail of what happens when a one solar mass black hole orbiting around a 10 to the 9th solar mass black hole, let's say at the center of a galaxy, loses energy and in spirals, and emits gravitational radiation, because this might be detectable by LISA, assuming LISA goes forward, even at cosmological distances. So you'd like to have accurate predictions of the motion of this body, small body, taking into account self-force effects, if you're going to accurately predict waveforms of gravitational radiation. Well, we're doing the electromagnetic problem, but that's a simpler problem and provides a very good testing ground for the ideas needed in the gravitational case. Now, in fact, we actually did, or Grella and I did, the gravitational case before we applied these ideas to the electromagnetic case, but it still did provide, I think, a very nice testing ground of these ideas. So the reason I would claim that people get confused and you could go a whole century debating these issues, really has to do with the way I think people think about classical electrodynamics, and certainly how it's taught in courses, because at least 95% of what's taught in courses focuses on one of the following two distinct and separate problems. Most of electromagnetic courses actually are spent given a distribution of charges or currents, find the electromagnetic field associated with that, and that is solve Maxwell's equations with the given source terms. A second problem that one spends a fair amount of time on in courses is if you're given electric and magnetic fields, you want to find the motion of a point charge, maybe embellished with extra multipole moments. You do this by solving the Lorentz force equation, possibly with additional dipole or higher multipole moment terms. Well, if you're doing either one of these two problems, then point charges are completely fine and make complete sense. Since Maxwell's equations are linear, you can certainly allow distributional sources such as point charges. In fact, even if you weren't interested in point charges and believed that all charges and currents are continuously distributed, as you should believe, it would still be convenient to solve Maxwell's equations with delta functions to get Green's functions, because then you can get the general solution from the Green's functions. So the point is, because Maxwell's equations are linear, there's just no problem finding the motion of a because Maxwell's equations are linear, there's no problem solving them with delta function sources. So that was problem number one. Problem number two, if you're interested in the motion of a charge in a given smooth electromagnetic field, well, you're just solving some ordinary differential equations, Lorentz force law or modified versions of that, and that's just not mathematically problematical. So at least 95% of what's done in courses in electromagnetism, you could perfectly well take the point of view that at a fundamental level, Maxwell's equations are formulated in terms of point charges, and continuous distributions are just some limit of having a lot of small point charges and average over them. In fact, I think this is the norm in electrodynamics courses. The problem is that if you are trying to do problems one and two simultaneously, this happens in Jackson before the last chapter where he's doing plasma physics, but there he treats the charges as continuous, so these problems don't arise. When you try to do one and two simultaneously, then point charges simply don't make sense. The coupled system of Maxwell's equations and the equations for the motion of the charges is a nonlinear system, and you just can't deal with distributional sources, at least not distributional sources like point charges. The obvious difficulty is that the field of a point charge is singular at its location and that it has infinite self-energy, which you can ignore in doing these problems separately, just can't be ignored in the coupled problem. So point charges are just don't make sense. This may sound radical to some people. It certainly shouldn't sound radical to people working in general relativity, where one is used to dealing with a nonlinear field equation. And although you'll find many books that talk about point masses and write down Lagrangians with point masses, the notion of a point mass doesn't make any sense in general relativity. In fact, if you tried to crunch down some body to try to make it approximate a point mass, it would collapse to a black hole before you could achieve any kind of point mass limit. Okay, but that's not the end of my talk. There is something to be said, and we will see point charges and point masses come back into the picture, but legitimately in a little while. But let me first say a little bit about what has been done, because as I said, there is more than 100 years of analysis of this. So one basic approach that goes back at least to Abraham and Lorentz is to consider a finite size body where the coupled Maxwell motion problem would make sense, but of course you have a motion problem of an extended body now, so the natural thing to do would be to make some simple assumption like a rigid shell for the body. Then you make approximations for small size of the body and derive equations of motion. So as I said, that was a line started at least by Abraham and Lorentz, but there are three major problems with doing this. It was okay for Abraham in 1903 and Lorentz in 1904 to assume rigid motion of a body or whatever, but after 1905, that is not a good idea because rigid motion just isn't consistent with special relativity if you have a body that's undergoing non-uniform acceleration, as you certainly have to consider in this cell force problem. So the there isn't any simple assumption like rigid motion that one can make, and one is really going to be stuck with considering the dynamics of a body. In this approach, it's also far from obvious that the motion of the body that you get out doesn't depend on your assumptions about the matter model. But I think the most serious problem with this approach is that it isn't clear what, if any, the range of validity it is, because you can't take the limit of zero size of the body without introducing the same infinite field and infinite self-energy problems that you had before. But you need to make assumptions about the body being small in order to make the approximation in the course of making the approximation. So it just isn't very clear a priori what the range of validity of these approximations are. A different line of approach to this, which goes back to Dirac, I think, was the first to do this, is to really work directly with a point charge, despite its infinities. But you could certainly consider the field of a point charge and work in some, look at energy and momentum fluxes in some whirl tube surrounding the point charge, which would all be finite, well-defined expressions. Of course, then when you take limits as you approach, as this whirl tube approaches the whirl line of the charge, you're guaranteed to end up with singular expressions somewhere or other. But Dirac found that these could be regularized or renormalized in what seemed to be a rather straightforward and natural way of doing things. I mean, my problems or criticisms with this are that, first, it's not obvious that it's correct, even if it looks kind of simple and natural. But I think more seriously, if you really believe this, then the main renormalization that you have to do is a so-called mass renormalization, where you cancel off the infinite self-energy of the charge itself with a bare mass, but you would have to give this body some infinitely negative bare mass. I mean, if you had negative masses around without charges, you could do all sorts of strange things. And it doesn't sound particularly physical for matter, the underlying matter, aside from the electromagnetic field, to have negative energy associated with it. In any case, both lines of approaches, and of course there have been many works over the last century or so following along these approaches that were started by Abraham, Lorentz, and Dirac, lead to a self-force which, in the non-relativistic limit, is given by the expression I've written down here, charge squared times time derivative of acceleration. And this is this force, self-force expression is usually referred to as the Abraham Lorentz Dirac expression. I mean, one can write down the relativistic version of this too. I'll do that later, but this is probably the more familiar form. But now this results in some serious difficulties and issues by itself, because the Newton equations of motion now is something that becomes third order in time, driven by this radiation reaction correction. So you've introduced additional degrees of freedom. If you want to specify initial conditions for the motion of a point charge now, you've got to specify not only its position and velocity, but its initial acceleration, which is somewhat disturbing. But much more disturbing is if you look at solutions of this equation, you get so-called runaway solutions where the position grows exponentially with time, at least in this non-relativistic approximation, at a very rapid time scale. So this equation admits what clearly seem to be highly unphysical solutions, and the discussion or the issue of how to exclude these clearly unphysical solutions also have been debated quite a bit over the past century. There's another strange feature of this Abraham-Lorentz Dirac force, which is worth definitely worth mentioning, which is if we have a body that, let's say, undergoes inertial motion, then is accelerated for a while, decelerated, and goes back to inertial motion at late times. Well, we all know that during this period of uniform acceleration that I put in here in the middle, the charge is radiating energy to infinity. But the Abraham-Lorentz Dirac force is zero during this period of uniform acceleration. So it looks like you are getting away with not conserving energy, that you're getting energy radiated for free without having to do any work on it. Now, if you look at this situation and take into account the very large ALD forces that you have to exert at the beginning of the end and integrate things up, you find that you don't get this energy for free. Energy is conserved on average. The total work that you do in overcoming the Abraham-Lorentz Dirac force is equal to the total energy radiated, which is good. But it's still very disturbing that it might appear that energy is only conserved on average, and you could locally get violations of conservation of energy. At least that's what it looks like might be possible with this. If you try to ask, are you violating conservation of energy? Well, then that gets you back into the same tangle that you get in with nearly everything else. Namely, you've got an infinite self-energy of a point charge, so you can't do a proper conservation of energy analysis. Okay, so that's review of issues that have been lying around. Now let me tell you about our approach. So we're going to use only Maxwell's equations and exact local conservation of energy and momentum. So whatever results we derive, we know are going to be consistent with exact local conservation. So if we get out the Abraham-Lorentz Dirac force, as we will, in a suitable sense, as I'll describe, then we know that what I just was describing here with the apparent violation of local energy conservation is just an illusion, that if you take into account all the energy and momentum lying in the electromagnetic field near the body and so on, that you really do have proper conservation. So Maxwell's equations I've just written down here in the usual covariant form. And conservation, by conservation of energy and momentum, I mean the divergence of the stress energy tensor is zero, where the stress energy tensor is the total stress energy tensor that's composed of some stress energy tensor of the material body that we're considering, and the stress energy tensor of the electromagnetic field. And I've written down here the formula, the standard formula for the stress energy of the electromagnetic field in terms of the electromagnetic field strengths, the electric and magnetic fields. By the way, I said that I was, perhaps a century behind the times, but I was exaggerating a bit on this. All the ingredients to do the work that we were doing were not in place 100 years ago. It was not until 1911, I believe, that the notion of the stress energy tensor in special relativity was introduced in this form, and that is needed in this analysis. So this all could have been done easily 99 years ago, but it would have been tough to do it 100 years ago. Okay, so I've said what equations we're going to use, but now I want to get on to the, really what the key idea of our approach. So, and the fundamental problem is, if we're considering some body, if we don't take the limit of zero size of the body, since we can't rely on, especially in special relativity, crutches like rigid bodies or something, we're going to have to take into account the internal dynamics of the body. Motion is going to be a complicated issue that's going to depend on the details of the composition of the body, its initial state, et cetera. If we don't take a limit of zero size, we're just not going to get any simple universal results. Maybe in some very special matter model we could do something, but we're just not going to be able to do anything general. On the other hand, if we take the usual point particle limit, where we imagine shrinking down some body to zero size, keeping its charge and mass fixed to make the usual notion of a point charge, then we're going to get, there are a lot of smart people in the last century who did this, and we're probably not going to get into, be able to do much better than those people who encountered serious problems with a singular electromagnetic field and infinite self-energy. I don't see how we're going to avoid that plaguing our analysis as well. So what we're going to do is consider a modified point particle limit where we have the body shrink to zero size. In fact, we're going to have it shrink to zero size in an asymptotically self-similar manner, as I'm going to describe. But we're going to do it in a way so that not only the size of the body goes to zero, but its charge and mass also go to zero proportionately to its size. Now, there is one drawback to this, which is then in the limit of, as we vary our parameter that's shrinking to zero, and lambda equals zero is shrinking down to zero size, in that limit, the body isn't there either. The body has completely gone away. It's not only zero size, it's zero charge and mass. But I think the best image to have here is that of the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland that disappears just like our body is, but is going to leave its smile behind. The point is that the world line that this body shrinks down to as a limiting world line is still a well-defined object that we can talk about, and that object is going to provide the leading order description of motion of the body. We can then work perturbatively off of the world line to recover self-force and dipole corrections to motion at first order, and additional, if we wanted to carry things further, in principle, additional self-force and higher multipole corrections to motion at higher orders. So that's the strategy. So, yeah?
What order would you think that the structure of the particle would come in?
First order. Electric and magnetic dipoles and spin are going to come in. We'll see that explicitly at first order.
But no details, just that
parameter. Right.
And at each order, some new parameter.
At each order, higher multipoles, yes. But I don't know we haven't gone beyond first order, so what happens with the self-force effects and whether there are corrections to that. I mean, test bodies have been successfully investigated, so there I know that only higher multipoles are going to come in at the whatever finite order we go to, but what happens to the self-force, you know, the non-test body effects at higher orders, I don't know, and that could start depending on details. But it doesn't, as it turns out, at first order. So let me be a little more explicit about this limit that we're taking. So we're considering some body that is going to shrink down to a world line. That is, we're considering some one parameter family of bodies that in the limit shrink down to a world line. If we were going to take a usual point particle kind of limit, then let's say for the charge density, this kind of scaling behavior with this 1 over lambda cubed out in front would exactly give us a sequence that approaches a delta function and keeps at each fixed time the shape of the object completely fixed. So this would be, if we were taking a usual point particle limit, and we wanted exact scaling of the body as it shrinks down to a point particle, point charge, this is the kind of limit that we would take, where this is just some arbitrary function that's smooth in all of its arguments. Well, I don't want to demand that it keep its shape exactly, so I'm going to allow lambda dependence in smooth lambda dependence in the way it shrinks down. But more importantly, I don't want it to shrink to a delta function. I want it I want the charge to go to zero proportionately to the size instead of going to a delta function. So I'm going to have a lambda to the minus 2 out in front here rather than a lambda to the minus 3. So
lambda to the minus 2 and other scalings?
Well, you mean, so you're really asking, so this is what will give me charge, and if I do the same thing with stress energy, mass proportional to size. Now, you could ask, why am I choosing proportional to size rather than proportional to size squared or
yeah.
square root of size? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, if I had the charge and mass going to zero any more slowly, I would start running back into trouble with singularities. If I had the charge and mass going to zero more rapidly, that would be fine, but then I would be dominated by multipole corrections, and I'd have to go to higher order to consider to find the self-force corrections. So it's, well, in principle, I could do that and slog through the lower orders that are just giving multipole corrections. It's much more efficient to choose this kind of scaling, and at this point in time, I consider it extremely natural, but it may have taken me a while to get used to it. But again, I can't make it go to zero more slowly, or things will be too singular, and making it go to zero more rapidly is being inefficient. So the precise statement then of what we're considering and what we want to analyze is as follows. So what we want to consider is some one-parameter family of Maxwell fields, charge current densities, and matter stress energy tensors that at each lambda satisfy the Maxwell equations and conservation of total stress energy, the only equations I'm going to impose, that have this kind of scaling behavior shrinking down to a world line that I've just been talking about and justified as best I can for the charge current and the matter stress energy. Okay, there's a Maxwell field here. I'm going to further assume then that the Maxwell field is the retarded solution associated with the charge current density that I have, plus some what I might call external field, which is some homogeneous solution of the vacuum Maxwell equations and has smooth dependence on lambda and the space-time coordinates. So that's what we're considering. What I want to know is, what are the possible world lines Zi of t that this can shrink down to? That'll give me the zeroth order equations of motion. And then what are the perturbative corrections to this world line that arise both from self field and finite size effects? I can't avoid considering both of them simultaneously because they're both going to be first order and lambda in this perturbative scheme. Okay, so this is the only slide that has some, this and its continuation is the only slide that has some key technical details in it. What we need to be able to get a lot of information, key information about the retarded solution associated with a charge current that is shrinking down to zero size in this manner. And there are two key results here that one can prove by just writing down the Green's function solution. I mean, we're in flat space-time here. With the Hadamard expansion techniques, I'm quite sure this will generalize to curved space-time, but we haven't actually done that yet. So the first property of this retarded solution is that it actually scales in the same kind of way as the charge current itself. It also becomes asymptotically self-similar near the charge. There's a different power of lambda out in front. It's lambda to the minus 1 rather than lambda to the minus 2. But the field of the charge actually does this same kind of asymptotically self-similar scaling near the charge. The other property is going to look a lot less obvious, and you would probably wonder why I'm doing this. So let me replace the variable lambda by a new variable, which I'm calling beta here, which is defined to be lambda over r. And obviously, I can write the retarded solution as a function of t beta r theta and phi if I switch to polar-like coordinates about with the origin centered at the world line. And the claim is that if I do this, why I'm doing this may be puzzling to you at the moment, but if I were to do this, one can prove, or we can prove, it takes 5 pages, journal pages of analysis, but we can prove that this retarded solution is in fact a smooth function of these coordinates, or specifically at fixed t, theta, and phi. This is a smooth function of beta and r, and in fact, it starts at beta squared. Lambda times the retarded solution is a smooth function of this. Why is this important and interesting? Well, because of the smoothness of this, including at, most importantly, including at zero values of both beta and r, we can do a Taylor expansion about 0, 0 here. I'm not assuming anything is analytic. I just mean, you know, Taylor approximation theorem that because this is a smooth function, I can approximate it quite well near 0 and 0 by its derivatives. And in fact, there are two ways of writing out this double Taylor series that I get about r equals beta equals 0 that are very useful to think about. So one is I can, here I've written r and beta. I've replaced the beta by its definition, lambda over r. This expansion shows you that at, which we refer to as the far zone expansion, tells you if you're, that if you're near the body and looking perturbatively in lambda, what it does, this the field starts off with a Coulomb-like field, and then as you go to higher and higher orders, you get more and more inverse powers of r in the expansion, which is, of course, valid only near r equals 0. Okay, but I can write this expansion in a completely equivalent way, defining new barred coordinates. I'm going to let r bar be r over lambda, t bar be t minus some arbitrarily chosen t naught over lambda. And then I can, writing r equals lambda r bar, and this is just 1 over r bar, I can rewrite this expression in this kind of series. So r bar you might think of as a scaled coordinate that's following the body in as it's shrinking down to zero size. As we let lambda go to zero and this body is scaling towards zero size, we can follow it in with these barred coordinates, keeping r bar fixed rather than r. And if I think of this so-called near zone viewpoint, we get a near zone expansion, which tells you that at least when you've rescaled f retarded appropriately by lambda, tells you that at lambda equals 0, this field is some stationary asymptotically flat field going to zero at infinity, at least like 1 over r bar squared and faster, solution. And then as you go to higher powers of lambda and make corrections, you get external field-like perturbations that grow with r bar. This expansion is valid at large r bar corresponding to small beta. This expansion is valid at small r. This terminology, near zone and far zone, is taken over from theory of matched asymptotic expansions, which these ideas are very closely related to. But I've not introduced any assumptions. These are facts about the retarded solution for a charge current source of the type we're considering. I mean, these are proven to hold. So let me say, since this is a key idea in this work, let me say in pictures a little bit more about what this near zone and far zone expansions are, and then I can tell you what we did and what the results and consequences are. So what I'm showing here is this one parameter family of space-times parameterized by lambda, one parameter family of bodies in flat space-time that are, as lambda goes to zero, shrinking down and eventually limiting to some world line gamma. And one way of considering this limit as lambda goes to zero is to stay at fixed global inertial coordinate, let's say, in the Minkowski space-time that we're dealing with. And that would correspond to following these blue lines in. And as we do that, of course, the body disappears. Its field goes to zero, finally, at lambda equals zero. This limit exists unless I'm on a line that is taking me right into gamma when the limit doesn't exist at all. But that corresponds to this far zone limit of letting lambda go to zero at fixed r. And this gives the description of the electromagnetic field that way. But the alternative is to pick a point on the world line labeled by time t naught and take every point in space-time and scale that toward t naught as I let lambda go to zero. And this defines a near zone limit. Well, the trouble is if I just do that, if I take the limit of the metric, I get a nicely defined metric, but it's zero. I'll need to rescale that metric to get something of finite size. I need to rescale the currents, the stress energy, and the fields. But if I rescale the fields appropriately, I get a well-defined limit this way. That corresponds, I've only done it for the field here in this formula, but that corresponds to the near zone limit. And that gives two, of course, completely equivalent perturbative descriptions of this, descriptions of this limit that I'm taking, that are, contain exactly the same information, but have very different pictures in terms of what's going on. So let me now briefly work in the far zone limit and derive the unperturbed motion. That is, I'm going to tell you what possible world lines this family of charged massive bodies can shrink down to. Yeah?
That expansion you showed us before, what would be the next term that you, or the estimate of the error that you're making in that?
Oh, well, this is just an expansion in R and beta. So if I stop here, what's left over is order R to the n plus 1, and this beta to the n plus 1.
So can they both be small?
Absolutely,
So where does that happen?
Well,
in the far zone.
If both lambda is small and r is small, but lambda is even smaller than r, then both alpha and beta, both r and beta will be small. So yeah, you have to have lambda smaller than, you need to have r small and lambda even smaller than r.
Okay, the other question was, going back to your ansatz for the everything for the fields and so on. I suppose it's really Lorentz invariant, although it doesn't look in that Lorentz invariant. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I mean, we have a world line picked out in here, so that's, I'm not sure of the sense in which you need a Lorentz invariant.
But you used T, didn't you use a background time in that ansatz?
The ansatz refers to a particular world line, Zi of T, that everything is shrinking down to. So
yes.
That's not Lorentz. I mean,
no, that's not. But I mean,
yeah. Otherwise, the scaling in the near zone limit scales the time coordinate as well. So there's nothing. Yeah, this is not anything like a post-Newtonian, a Newtonian or post-Newtonian type limit where you would treat the time and space differently. They're being treated on an equal footing, and there'll be no small velocity type approximations or assumptions made in this.
Right, I understand you're not.
Yeah.
But doesn't it, well, maybe I'm just confused, but doesn't the form of that ansatz, you could make the same ansatz in a different frame and it wouldn't be literally, I mean,
this is completely independent of coordinates, if that's the
question. That's what I meant.
Yeah, make any smooth coordinate transformation and this will still be the case. I mean, that we have to worry about in the general relativity version of this, so. Yeah, we did check that. We did prove that. Yeah, so the ansatz is independent of what background coordinates you're using. Okay, so getting back to taking this far zone limit, so stand at fixed r and let lambda go to zero. Well, if we do that, as we've already noted, the current goes to zero. But the first order perturbation of the current, basically gives us an extra inverse power of lambda or whatever to work with. And that, not surprisingly, it's easy to see, goes to a delta function. So the first order perturbed description of the current is a delta function, but with some arbitrary function of time in here and arbitrary index dependence. However, if we now impose conservation of current, which is a consequence of Maxwell's equations, we find that, in fact, this perturbed current has to be exactly of this normal point charge form, where u is the tangent to the world line that we're shrinking down to. Similarly, we find that the stress energy, of course, of the matter goes to zero, but its first order perturbed form goes to a delta function. However, this isn't conserved by itself, so we can't, at the moment, say anything more about that. But now if we look at the electromagnetic stress energy, we can break that up into the external field stress energy tensor. I mean, it's quadratic in the field, so it's something quadratic in the external field, something quadratic in the self fields, and a cross term between them. One of the sort of, well, surprises, although maybe it shouldn't have been in this, but I certainly was personally confused about this for a good month as to how this could come about, is that if you take the limit of the self field part of the stress energy, you get a delta function. Now, the field itself, you can see from the far zone expansion, is starting like lambda, so the field squared goes like lambda squared, so you might think it would be second order, but in fact if you take into account what the field is doing inside the body, which is all accounted for in our, in the results I've already shown you, in the way that the field depends on alpha and beta and begins with beta squared, on r and beta and begins with beta squared, one finds that, in fact, the first order correction of the self field is actually a delta function. It does go to zero outside the body where that what I just showed you is correct and the things would be proportional to lambda squared at fixed r, but inside the body, when you take that into account, the electromagnetic self field makes a contribution and ends up being a delta function. That isn't so surprising if you think of the electromagnetic self energy, because that should be something like charge squared over radius, and charge squared is going like lambda squared, but radius is going like lambda, so overall you should get a contribution proportional to lambda, which is what we have here. But now, since both of these are delta function, and the sum of them, well, actually isn't conserved, but is equal to the divergence of the cross term, which is easily calculable, when you put in conservation of total stress energy, you find that the total stress energy, that is matter field plus its self field, so I take this part and add it to the matter stress energy, that is exactly of the standard point particle form, and you find that the whorl line of the body has to satisfy the Lorentz force equation in the external field. So what have we just derived? That to first order in lambda, the description of any body is exactly that of a textbook classical point charge mass that moves on a Lorentz force trajectory in the external field. And we found more than that. We've also found that the electromagnetic self-energy of the body contributes to its mass, because that's included in the total stress energy that that corresponds to the mass of the body. T mu nu m is the stress energy of the matter that, you know, is making up the material body. Nothing. The only thing we assume is that the total stress energy is conserved. We assume only that the matter has a stress energy tensor, and then we assume that the sum of it and the electromagnetic stress energy is conserved. I mean, of course, we've assumed that the matter stress energy tensor is shrinking down to the whorl line in this asymptotically self-similar manner. So this is certainly being used in the analysis. Yeah?
So I think from what you said, that means the analysis would be equally valid if, for example, the matter stress energy actually was had some cross terms between it and the electromagnetic field. Because you haven't assumed that there
no,
is.
No, I have assumed
have
that
you assumed something that.
Yeah.
That's what wasn't clear. You make no assumptions on team on matter. How are you ruling
this
out?
Is our assumptions.
Right.
But that the total stress energy is just the sum of matter and electromagnetic.
But that could still have electromagnetic terms in it somehow. As long as T mu nu EM is what you say it is. You just call the rest T mu.
Right, but then it probably would not be reasonable to assume that the matter stress energy is shrinking down in this way if we don't have any control over cross terms with the electromagnetic field and so on. I mean, this would be a questionable assumption. I mean, you know, it might be an assumption that's inconsistent if there were terms involving the electromagnetic field, because we can't control those. I mean, we can't control those other than what they are from the current.
But I mean, your model of the charge might be something that doesn't even have a clear distinction between electric. You know, it might be a gut model. Who knows?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, our assumptions are, I don't think our assumptions could be weakened very much, though. I mean, we're not assuming anything much. Okay. So, but we weren't interested in doing all this work to rederive the Lorentz force law. What we really want is, the corrections to this, in particular, the first order and lambda corrections. But that gets us into a problem, because we didn't have to sweat at all with what our whorl line was when things were shrinking down to a whorl line. But now when we're making finite lambda corrections, you know, at any finite lambda, the body is an extended body of some finite size. There isn't a particular whorl line. We have to say what whorl line is representing the motion of the body at finite lambda. Now, there's an obvious choice that we make from high school on or whatever to make to represent the world line of a body, namely the center of mass. But I want to emphasize that it's highly non-trivial to define a notion of center of mass for a body with charge and an electromagnetic field associated with it, because we've just seen that electromagnetic self-energy can't be ignored in the mass. It makes a contribution to the mass of the body, so it better be allowed to make a contribution to the center of mass of the body. But the body will have radiated some electromagnetic field 2 weeks ago. That's off 2 light weeks away, 2 light weeks away from us. Now, I sure don't want to include that radiation in the notion of the center of mass of the body. It really is total, but there's no obvious way of making a distinction between the sort of self-field Coulomb energy of the body and the radiation it emitted 2 weeks ago. I mean, maybe the stuff it emitted 2 weeks ago, there's a clean distinction, but, 2 nanoseconds ago, there isn't a clean distinction. This is a difficult obstacle that will, in fact, have to be tackled head-on and solved to go to higher order than we went. But to go to first order, in fact, there's a because of the effective stationarity of the system at the order that we're working in, we didn't have to do anything sophisticated and could include the electromagnetic self-energy. I'll show you that in a minute, but I wanted to make this point here that there is a non-trivial obstacle to going to higher orders, which simply has to do with how you want to define the notion of the world line that's representing the motion of the body. So to proceed, it's convenient to work in Fermi coordinates, which really for all that I'm going to do is the most important thing is that the world line will automatically be located at zero value of the spatial coordinates. I'm not making any assumptions. I'm just adapting our coordinates to the world line. I'm going to proceed now working in the near zone limit. And I warned you before that we would have to rescale things like the metric and the other fields in order to get well-defined finite limits, and these are the rescalings. It looks like J and T are scaling differently, but that's just an artifact of my having put an index up here and indices down there. These are the rescaled fields, and one can show that they have well-defined finite limits then as lambda goes to zero, and these rescaled fields are all stationary at lambda goes to zero. I mean, this is the near zone limit. Okay, so to define the center of mass, working in this near zone picture, we have some finite mass, well-defined object in the near zone in the limit as lambda goes to zero. This is its total stress energy. We define it, the metric is flat in the near zone limit, and the Fermi coordinate limit is flat. This is the mass, and this is the obvious straightforward definition of center of mass, and we're going to impose the condition that the center of mass be zero as the condition that defines the world line, because the world line is located at zero, and we want that to correspond to the center of mass. That's just explaining how we're going to proceed. Okay, we have standard definitions of other body parameters. There's a spin tensor whose time components are essentially the center of mass, and the space components are the usual notions of angular momentum, or spin, and there's a spin vector that we can define from that. We have a notion of perturbed mass. We have the obvious notion of charge of the body. We have a notion of perturbed charge when we work to first order in lambda. Then we have a notion of electromagnetic dipole tensor that comes into play, whose time-space components are the electric dipole moment, and whose space-space components are give the magnetic dipole moment. So those were just definitions now working in the near zone. And now I'll just tell you our strategy and our results. Yeah?
So it seems to make a lot of sense to keep only the self-turning unit in the magnetic sensor, but it makes sense to remove the radiation current. My question has to do with cross-terms. It's a matter of debate whether you should include that.
I am not including the cross-terms.
Could you do that, or is there more clear?
Well, I'm not doing it. In fact, we'll see that it seems to be nice to redefine the mass to include the electric dipole cross terms at the approximation that we're working in. So, you know, you could do that. I will explain that. But anyway, I'm not doing that. I'm including only the body stress energy and its self field, not the cross terms of its field with the external field in the definition of mass. But I think if your question is, could I have done that, I think the answer is yes. And would there have been dire consequences, I think the answer is no. It would be half nice to do that. There's an argument for including about half of the cross term in the definition, as we'll see. Okay, but I better move on. So now I'm just going to tell you what our strategy is and what qualitatively the results are, and then exactly what the results are. We just write down the only equations we have, Maxwell's equations, which in particular include conservation of charge current. That's really all we need because we're taking the retarded solution. Conservation of stress energy in going up to second order in the near zone expansion. Then we multiply the relations that we get by writing these out by various powers of xi bar up to quadratic or so order, integrate, and get whatever relations we can possibly get between all of these body parameters that we've just defined. Okay, so at zeroth order, we learn about anti-symmetry of spin and dipole tensors and some other basic relations. At first order, we find that the mass is time independent and that the spin evolves by what is actually the usual dipole torque equation. And we recover the Lorentz force law. The acceleration of the whirl line has to be given by the Lorentz force equation. This is, of course, in Fermi coordinates, so we're at rest with respect to the body, so there's only an electric field coming in here. At second order, we get the equations that we were looking for. We get an equation for the perturbed acceleration due to the finite size and finite charge, et cetera, corrections. And we also get a non-trivial evolution equation for the perturbed mass. We don't get an evolution equation for the electromagnetic dipole tensor, and we wouldn't have expected to because that should be model dependent. Okay, so these equations, if rewritten in covariant form, translated from the Fermi coordinates, give what I've written here. I'm not going to belabor this because I'm going to write the equations in non-relativistic form, which will look familiar. But I will point out this is a dipole energy sort of correction to the mass, which is natural to incorporate in the definition of mass just from the way the equations come out. And let me look at these. So this is the perturbed evolution equation, taking into account now these first-order corrections due to finite charge and finite size. So let me skip over the term that I'm really interested in momentarily to point out that, well, this is the field interaction energy that Eric was asking about which could naturally be taken over to this side and incorporated into a perturbation of the mass. Okay, that's all I'll say about that. These are the usual dipole force terms that you find in textbooks, elementary and advanced textbooks or whatever. These are, a spin acceleration term that doesn't appear, to the best of my knowledge, in any electromagnetic textbook, though it should. And dipole terms, well, this one doesn't appear, as far as I know, in any electromagnetic textbook. This is in the latest editions of Jackson, but was not in the first edition of Jackson that I used as a graduate student. But a magnetic dipole in an electric field, where either the dipole or the electric field is time dependent, will have a force on it. Okay, but let me go back to the term that I'm really interested in. That's the usual formula for the Abraham-Lorentz Dirac force, but it's now here derived as a perturbative correction to the force. So there isn't any issue here of runaway solutions or anything like that, because this term, every term on the right side of the equation, has to do with the background solution. So this A is the A of the Lorentz force background solution to the equations of motion. The actual Newton's equations of motion at first order are still second order equations. There's no change in the order of the equations. There's no change in the runaway behavior. There's no runaway behavior or anything like that. Right, so that's what I've just said. Okay, but that's not quite the end of the story, because these equations, or this perturbed motion equation, should provide a good description for the deviation from Lorentz force motion due to the dipole and radiation reaction term, as long, of course, as they're locally small. If they're large, we're outside the context of the perturbation theory that we're working in, so all bets are off then. But this is still not a good situation, because even if the perturbative correction, even if this Abraham-Lorentz force is locally small, if we wait a few weeks, its effects will build up, and we're going to get a very large deviation in this perturbative formalism from the original Lorentz force trajectory, and our perturbative description is clearly not going to be very good. It's going to be a terrible thing to try to describe the motion as a perturbation of a given Lorentz force trajectory once the trajectory is deviating quite a bit from that. So a natural question to ask is, can we do better than this? Can we improve upon this purely perturbative description that I've rigorously derived in the manner that I said, to get something that would be a better global in time description of the motion that won't start becoming bad once the deviations from my original Lorentz force trajectory have become large? Now, talking to people about this, the usual reaction one would get, and can you do better? Well, yeah, let's go to second order or third order or eighth order or something. But going to any finite order isn't going to help very much. Once the deviations from the original background solution are large, a perturbative description is just not going to be very good. But I claim that you can do a lot better than this, assuming, of course, that the idea is, as I may have, instead of building a perturbative description based on a single Lorentz force trajectory, try to get something that is varying the Lorentz force trajectory that you're perturbing off of, and keeping things so that the deviation from that Lorentz, varying Lorentz force trajectory is small. So what I claim is needed to improve this description of motion is to invent, and I do mean invent, what we call a self-consistent perturbative equation corresponding to the perturbative results that we obtain that does the job of correcting this Lorentz force trajectory as you go along instead of working off a fixed Lorentz force trajectory. Now, this may sound like we're going off on some wild tangent here, but I claim that in physics, everybody does this all the time. It's just nobody pays any attention to it or notices that they're doing it. I would claim it's okay to do this, provided that your invented equations have a well-posed initial value formulation, assuming your original ones did, that your invented equations don't introduce new degrees of freedom or remove old ones, for that matter, so that you can make correspondences between initial data for your invented equations and the original unperturbed and a perturbed equations, and then for corresponding initial data, most importantly, the solution to your invented equation should be very close to the corresponding solution of the perturbative system over the time interval for which the first order perturbative system is believed or known to be accurate. So I don't know of any reason why in any given system there need exist any self-consistent perturbative equations, and I certainly wouldn't expect them to be unique when they exist. But I claim people do this all the time, and the obvious thing to do is just to combine the zeroth and first order equations into a single equation that is then gets treated as though it were exact. And I claim that people do this all the time. They take some result that's an approximation that is rigorously true in first order perturbation theory, and then they just throw that term into their equation and then treat it as though that was the exact equation and work with that equation. And that is normally a very good way of inventing a self-consistent perturbative equation. But in the present case, that's a disaster, because if we just add the Abraham-Lorentz Dirac term to the usual in non-relativistic form Lorentz force equation, we get this extra degree of freedom and the unacceptable runaway solutions. But there's a perfectly good alternative available, which is to replace this A that appears here on the right side of the equation by its Lorentz force expression. Well, if I just take this and substitute it in for A, I'm going to pick up another A from the derivative of V. So I'll again, for that A, substitute this. This procedure is known as reduction of order, and the reduced order A Abraham-Lorentz-Dirac equation should give a completely accurate description of the motion of a point charge. And that, I think, is, that's as far as one can go in first order, having derived results only in first order perturbation theory, but I think it's a completely satisfactory and correct description then of how you would describe long-term motion that deviates only a little bit from Lorentz force motion. Okay, I've run over time, but I want to give one quick application. This is my very last slide except for the punchline, the one sentence punchline on the next continuation of this. But this is an issue that comes up in freshman physics classes all the time, and it certainly bothered me as taking college physics, and I never heard a good explanation of this, although there ought to exist some in the literature. I haven't checked, but here is a problem that that students should be legitimately asking about, because there is a contradiction in what people are normally told. I mean, a blatant, obvious, not subtle contradiction, right? So you got a big magnet and a little tiny magnet here, and you take this little big magnet is anchored and fixed and at rest. This little tiny magnet you release from rest, and high school, et cetera, and even pre-high school students know pretty well that this little magnet's going to go flying toward the big magnet. And the kinetic energy of this little magnet certainly increases when you release it. Now, how is energy conserved in this? Well, what I hear people saying all the time is that, well, you have this magnetic dipole interaction energy of the, you know, field and of the dipole and the magnetic field of this external magnet, and the energy comes, the energy then is delivered to this little body that goes flying off via, you know, robbing some of this dipole interaction energy, making the total energy conserved. But another thing we tell our freshman students indicates that this can't possibly be correct, because everybody knows, or everybody's told, that a magnetic field, a static magnetic field, cannot do any work on another object. So if we have this little magnet here, the static external field of the big magnet cannot do any work on it and cannot be supplying any energy to this little body. So the energy of this little body, I claim, must be constant. Nevertheless, it has picked up kinetic energy. So my question is, where does this kinetic energy that this little magnet picks up come from? How is energy conserved in this process? Excuse me?
Internal energy of the dipole.
Well, okay. I mean, the punchline is that it comes from the rest mass of the body. Of course, you know, rest mass includes all internal energy and so on of the dipole, but the this magnetic dipole really does become lighter. The magnet really does become lighter, both in its gravitational effects and its inertial mass effects, as it falls towards this magnet. The energy is coming from its rest mass or its internal energy. Okay. Anyway, that is an application. I mean, that does follow from our mass evolution equations of motion here. If I wrote that out in some form that would be more readable. Anyway, I've run over time, so let me, that's all I wanted to say, so let me end here. Well, this is classical, so
yes.
I mean,
yes.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know how to model intrinsic spin other than as spin, I mean, classically.
And then, do you have any comments on the gravitational case?
Yeah, I mean, we've done the gravitational case, but what we've done, and we did that before the electromagnetic case, what we did in the gravitational case is make assumptions not work with the, in the gravitational case, it's going to be hopeless to work with sources because there's no, for strong field objects, there's no clear relationship between source and external field. So what we did in the gravitational case is just make the analog of this assumption. Now, that wasn't tremendously justified in the gravitational case because we hadn't shown this first in the electromagnetic case. So this work is really somewhat justifying that. But for the metric, this smoothness, joint smoothness in beta and R is what we need. And doing that, we can derive the analog of these equations of motion, as well as evolution of spin and evolution of mass. In the gravitational case, the mass is constant to the order that we're working in. We get dipole terms from the spin in the gravitational case, which are just the Papa-Petru force terms that have been derived And we get a radiation reaction force term, which is now not a local term in acceleration. The background acceleration vanishes because the background motion is geodesic. But we get this so-called tail integral term that people have written down, you know, long prior to this. So we basically re-derive the results that had been believed, well, in a first-order perturbative form. And that, but that all comes from just the assumption that you have this kind of near zone and far zone limiting behavior as specified by the smoothness in those variables.
How is this related to the von Hinfeld theory, or any way of solving this?
Well, they I haven't studied that work, but they tried to modify, Maxwell's equations and matter equation in order to try to get rid of this self-energy problem, and I just think that's misplaced. There isn't any self-energy problem. If you give up on the notion of a point charge, and I'm claiming you should give up on the notion of a point charge, and people in general relativity, have certainly given up on the notion of a point mass, and I don't see why point charge should make more sense than a point point charge in electromagnetism with matter. Combined motion should make any more sense than the notion of a point mass in general relativity, then there just is no problem. But, one of the things I really like about this work is it shows why it is, why this notion of point charge and point mass naturally arises. It arises in first order perturbation theory for a very small body of also very small mass and charge. In the gravitational case, we derive in the linearized gravity description the description of any body also as a point mass, which in linearized gravity does make sense.
So you introduced this paradox about a constantly accelerating charge that at the beginning, and then you have like infinite force, and then in between nothing. So how is that resolved here?
Yeah, that would be interesting to look at in detail. So what I claim this work shows is that that is not a problem. Energy is exactly conserved locally everywhere because we've used that to derive these equations.
But is there any force in between these two?
No, there's no. The formulas are right. What people say are right, but there is no self force. There's no self-force on the body during the period of uniform acceleration. But energy is exactly conserved locally at every point of space and every instant of time. I mean, it's not when you realize that this body has, an electromagnetic self field and the properties of that self field are, that self field does contribute to its mass here, and I don't know. It's not so shocking, but it still is surprising, and I don't have a clear picture as to how it is that energy and momentum are exactly conserved locally, but they are. I'm certain of that, unless we made a mistake in our calculation.
You said that there were two notions of mass that one can define depending on this dipole term. So which one would enter Newton's law of gravitation?
Well, the stress energy tensor is what appears in Einstein's equation. I can't speak for Newton, but it would appear in Einstein's equation. So, but of course, as Eric would then point out, the interaction energy, stress energy between the field and the external field also appears in Einstein's equation. So, but that would not be entirely localized near the body, although some of it would be localized near the body, actually. This is the Newton equation of motion, but you perfectly well could incorporate this dipole energy into the mass, which is what I did over here. That is the dipole energy term, and I've written it, incorporated into the mass into this equation. So as far as inertial mass is concerned, the electric dipole energy, but not the magnetic dipole energy, appears to contribute to the mass, as well as the self field always contributes to everything. But the interaction energy, the dipole energy, appears to contribute to the inertial mass. And both interaction energies would contribute to magnetic and electric, would contribute to Einstein's equation, but not necessarily localized near where the particle is. The self field will always contribute to the gravitational mass.
So you mentioned at the beginning that this is a situation where, because of nonlinearity, it's distributional solutions don't make sense. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be careful about how you pick the limit if you want to get answers that are finite and people. So I guess it sounds sort of very much like quantum field theory, where, mm-hmm. you know, in, for example, a QED, because you have these nonlinearities, the distribution doesn't make sense and so forth. So is there any possible relation? Like, is there some perhaps a like similar procedure you could use to quantize QED differently?
Yeah, so I mean there's certainly a lot of mathematical or some mathematical similarity between what's going on here and what's going on in quantum field theory. However, the classical theory we know how to formulate in a completely well-posed way, and I would say that all the problems in the classical theory are artifacts of trying to take the wrong kinds of limits, like the point particle limit that people usually take rather than the point particle limit that we're taking. But for quantum field theory, I don't have any story like that. I don't know how to formulate it consistently without the problems. So maybe if and when there is a, you know, mathematically consistent, completely well-defined formulation of quantum field theory, one will see that it is, you know, the infinities that people are getting in perturbation theory are all artifacts of this. But at the moment, no, I don't have any story like that, nor am I confident that there is such a story.
One last question?
I'll just make a brief comment on the IRS's question. But if you have a large force, this is the uniform acceleration question, that's it. If you have a large force in the rest frame, presumably the approximation breaks down, a large external force. But as long as it's small in the rest frame, then the comment is that although it can be small in the beginning, but then it becomes, if you wait long enough, it's moving very rapidly and the final force looks very big that you need to compensate. But actually, if you transform it to its rest frame again, it again looks small. So there's mm-hmm. this kind of self-consistency in the picture.
Yeah.
It makes it look less weird, less strange.
Right.
Less no, I mean,
well, what I agree with what you said. I mean, what I was saying seemed disturbing is that you could have this arbitrarily long period of uniform acceleration where you're radiating an enormous amount of
right.
energy to infinity and seem not to be paying for it at all because
that's
you're exerting no extra, there's no Abraham Lorentz Dirac force. So all the force you're exerting is going into the, you know, momentum, the four momentum, you know, and energy of this particle. So it looks like you're gaining energy.
That's right.
And only paying for it later or earlier, which sounds like some conservation of energy only on average or something. And that's just not the case. You have exact conservation all along if you really keep track of where all the electromagnetic
yes.
field energy is at all times and all that.
But then I wanted to ask you, so in your extra terms that you said that Jackson didn't have, one of them appeared to have a universal character. It didn't seem
yeah.
to mention the charge or anything like
right.
that. Right. So what do you have something, nice words to say about that?
We have a about 50 preprint pages journal paper that may have been sent to the archives in the last hour, a couple of hours, or it will be tomorrow, that talks a lot about this, because this is what is, I claim, well, the gravitational analog of this is what is going on with the bobbing of spinning black holes that are orbiting around each other. If you have two spinning black holes with spins anti-aligned in the orbital plane, you see a very noticeable in the numerical simulations bobbing of the orbital plane. That's this term in the suitable gravitational version of it, we claim. You get this for tether balls, you know, spinning balls connected by an elastic band orbiting around each other. This is sort of a mechanics analog of Thomas precession.
I was going to say, it looks a lot like Thomas precession.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not, I mean, it isn't the Thomas precession, it's not, you know, it's a different, but it's similar in that it's of a completely universal kinematic character. And it seems to have been generally completely overlooked in every analysis of almost everything. I mean, you can find this in that term in, you know, some references. We're certainly not the first to point it out, but.
So how do people derive it when they don't derive it this way? Or do they derive it this way? Do they derive this?
The people, I think the references where it exists are fairly, well, it might effectively be in Dixon stuff, you know, motion. Well, actually, no, probably, I'm sorry, no, probably not. I can't remember the reference, but I mean some, you know, general derivations of equations of motion, you know, with general definitions of momentum and so on, you know, do contain this kind of term. I mean, the presence of this term is tied into the definition of center of mass and things of that sort, but I mean, so is the Thomas precession, I guess, too. But
okay, let's thank Mr. Paul again.